Good morning. My name is Elizabeth Toomey. On behalf of the appellant, JKN, may it please the court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, please. This case involves interpreting the court's orders. That's primarily the first assignment of error. But it also turns on the meaning of what is a disposition. So we have two very important orders here in this case. The first order was the order dated January 10th, 2013, which ordered supervised probation pending the disposition. So what is meant by disposition? In this context, it's the equivalent of a sentencing hearing for an adult. We do have a statute to look at. 16.1, 278.8 is the statute that governs juvenile sentencing.
Well, I guess the big issue that jumps out at me is the juvenile court uses the word disposition in its orders twice.
Correct.
And it seems to me your argument has to be that it meant one thing the first time it used it, and it meant something else the second time it used it. Because the order that you says erases everything before says disposition is deferred. And since the first order says until disposition, you're on probation, why is it an order saying disposition deferred, continuing the probation?
Because that's not what it said.
Well, it said
that the defendant's
motion for a deferred disposition is granted. Disposition is deferred.
Yes.
Disposition is continued for 3 months.
Correct.
That means disposition isn't occurring today. It's occurring in 3 months, doesn't it?
No. Because a deferred disposition is a specific type of sentence that the juvenile court can essentially hand down.
That's pushing off sentence, is it not? I mean, having spent a few years on the juvenile domestic relations court bench, I don't remember ever conducting a disposition when I was deferring a disposition.
Well, when the deferred disposition is granted, the court can obviously set certain types of terms, whatever terms the court requires. But when the court grants that deferred disposition, that's under the statute. So that's under 278.8A4. So you can defer the disposition with certain terms or no terms. In this case, once the court granted that deferred disposition, that is when the new terms took effect. So just because...
But that's just carrying forward something they had chosen to do before, that is defer the disposition, correct?
Well, initially...
No affirmative release from any previously imposed conditions.
Well, initially the disposition was deferred to another date just to see what was going to happen. That was the January 10th, 2013 order. So no sentence at all had been discussed because they wanted to see what was going on, how she was going to do, and to determine what the sentence should ultimately be. Then on July 25th, 2014, is when the court did grant that deferred disposition and set certain terms.
I understand your petition, you're saying that the circuit court refusing to effectively overrule, and that's, of course, technically the wrong word because it's not an appeal in the traditional sense, it's a trial to novo, which really goes on the computer harassment.
Correct.
Conviction itself raises all kinds of questions. But you're alleging that the circuit court erred in overruling the juvenile and domestic relation court's judge's determination about its own orders. So you're asking us to reverse a court for deferring to the interpretation of an order it didn't make, but another court made. Is that fair?
Well, I guess. So obviously the appeal to the Court of Appeals, or to the Circuit Court, would have been an appeal de novo. And so then it would be the Circuit Court's decision that we're appealing. So the Circuit Court can't necessarily know what the juvenile court was thinking.
Setting aside the probation question, turning to the conviction itself, which you also appear to be asking us to overturn.
Right, because I think they're one and the same.
Well, I think they're different. And they're different because if it's a trial de novo, isn't the whole question in front of the circuit court, was there sufficient evidence that she committed the offense? Obviously, she said she committed the offense. That's sufficient evidence. The court doesn't have to offer a stare disposition at all. In fact, if I understand your argument, you're asking a court that never offered a stare disposition to be bound by an offer of a prior court that made an offer of a stare disposition but then said the conditions for granting it weren't met. Once you appeal that, isn't it just a brand new trial on the computer harassment charge?
Let me make sure I understand. So, I mean, first of all, I don't believe that the deferred disposition is a stare disposition.
Okay.
Because there's statutory authority.
There is
for
a
it.
Statute. But,
it was the appeal of the sentence on the computer harassment charge. So obviously the entire trial, we didn't have a new trial on the computer harassment charge.
But
so
you would have been entitled to one, correct?
If it's de novo,
I suppose
it's
if we had sort of set that out in our appeal, I suppose, but that wasn't the issue. I mean, issue
that's
was
not the way appeals are set out from juvenile court to circuit court, correct?
In this case, she was only appealing the finding of violation, because if she's not found in violation, then the court would have dismissed the original charge as well.
But when she's found
really
in violation,
only,
that's when you have a finding that's entered that finds her delinquent
right.
on the petition.
Right.
So when you appeal that,
right.
you're necessarily not just appealing the disposition, you're also appealing the finding. The whole case goes up.
In this case, it was limited only to the disposition.
Basically, so if I understand you, the way it was appealed, even though it was a
right.
trial de novo,
right.
conceded that she did the act.
Yes. Correct.
Well, then, isn't the only a question in a de novo appeal on that part of it, on whether she's guilty of the offense, as to whether the court wanted to accept her stipulation that she was guilty of the offense?
I believe that and the way that the parties addressed it was that it was dependent on the violation itself.
Once she appealed from the Juvenile and Domestic Relations Court,
yes.
didn't that render all the discussion about a deferred disposition a nullity? Because it is a trial de novo, and that everything that happened below disappears, except that which the party stipulated to, which in this case was that she had, in fact, committed the offense.
Correct. I suppose because the parties had all been limiting it to that one particular aspect about whether or not she violated, so whether or not it should have been the disposition, I would say that I think that that became the law of the case. Would be my best answer.
But that doesn't bind, just because the parties agreed to it, that doesn't bind the circuit court in its decision-making on a case that's before it in de novo fashion, correct?
Well, basically from the transcript and from essentially being there, but that was the trial judge was holding, she was ruling on that issue only.
She did not take back
up the entire.
And it's convenient because just two arguments ago, we spent a lot of time with the law of the case doctrine, but
right.
that necessarily involves an appellate court. And although we use terminology like appealed to circuit court, the circuit court is not an appellate court. It's a brand new trial. Everything starts over, right?
Yes.
So then it can't be law of the case because there's no appellate court involved. It's a brand new start from scratch trial.
Well, then I would say that the Commonwealth then presented no evidence that she was, in fact, guilty of that charge.
Because she stipulated to it, and therefore they
she
didn't have
to. She stipulated to the violation. Well, she stipulated to the underlying facts, not that she was in violation.
Well, right, but the
so
facts.
She stipulated that she had left home and that sort of thing, but that was the extent of the stipulation.
Well, I'm talking about the underlying computer harassment charge first, because those two things are, in fact, separate.
Yes.
Okay. I'm still finding it difficult to understand your argument about why in the July 25th, 2014 order, when at that point is clear that the matter has been deferred until that point, and then the court on that date says, all right, well, we'll see, and sets terms, we'll see how things are 3 months from today. Why does that mean, where is there a case that says that means all of a sudden she's no longer on probation?
Well, I believe it's similar to the White case, because I believe that when the court grants a deferred disposition, that is similar to granting a 251 disposition, which White involved.
Even when you're just postponing it, 3 more months, essentially.
The court can set however many, it could have been a one-day deferred granting of a deferred disposition.
And that wipes
and it doesn't
out
matter.
Any probation unless the court then says again, you're still on probation.
Right. That's our position, exactly. So that the granting of a deferred disposition is just the same as a 251 disposition. Neither are a final disposition, but they are sentences that then would take over in the context of an adult. So once an adult receives a 251 disposition, then that would supersede any prior bond orders if there had been bond conditions. It would be the same thing, is our argument, that those two are analogous. And so that the White case does, in fact, control this case. With respect to assignment of error number 2, I did point out in my brief that it was a bit unclear about what the trial court's holding was here, but we also believe that this violation of curfew and leaving home is not a uniform due behavior violation either.
Would you concede that if she were still on probation, either under another interpretation of, that I just described, or if the March order saying she was on indefinite probation still held force here, that if she's, regardless, if she's still on probation, then it would be a violation?
Well, that leans into our assignment number 3, but yes. Setting aside any due process arguments, yes. And that's why we had stipulated to the underlying facts that she had violated her curfew and that she'd left home. We were just simply arguing that it's not a violation of the court's, it's not a violation of probation. Probation in the larger sense, I suppose, not
good
necessarily
behavior requirement.
Correct. So it's neither one of those.
Well, why?
I think the due process argument is.
I have to ask you on that, though. I mean, she's going through all of this. She's supposed to be staying with her mother, and the court's been in contact with the mother. Everything's going okay, and then she just disappears for between 2 to 3 days. Her mother has no idea where she is, nor does any other responsible adult. Why isn't that a violation of good behavior?
Because I don't think that it meets the court's precedent for a violation of good behavior. It's not a violation of the law, and it's not substantial misconduct, and it's not
iniquitous. But good behavior doesn't have to be a violation of a law.
It could include, certainly, it could include either substantial misconduct or iniquitous behavior. It's not iniquitous behavior, it's not wicked or sinful or gross immorality. So then the analysis
might
would
think
be
differently than that. If your child disappears for 2 to 3 days, and you're responsible for them, you don't know where they are.
Well, under some of the only things I could find on iniquitous behavior are unpublished cases, but I did cite to some in my brief, and those were things like masturbating in jail, being discharged from a shelter for asking for sex, making unwanted advances toward staff, threatening to rape children. So those are all sort of the iniquitous type that the courts have analyzed under the iniquitous standard. So it has to be sort of that immorality type thing.
You're welcome to continue, but you're into your rebuttal time.
I will save for rebuttal. Thank you.
Ms. Adelfio.
May it please the court. Good morning. Catherine Adelfio on behalf of the Commonwealth. This case boils down to two facts. The defendant was on probation at the time that she ran away from home. And under just plain common sense, when you are 15 years old, good behavior requires that you do not run away from home for 3 days, 2 nights, and fail to let any guardian know of your whereabouts. To return to my first point, the defendant was on probation because the July 2014 order was not a final order, and the January 2013 order continued probation pending the final disposition of the case. Because the July 2014 order did not find her guilty, explicitly continued the case so that the court could confirm that she complied with the conditions, and retained jurisdiction of the case to reconsider its earlier judgment. This was clearly not a sentencing order. It was, in fact, another continuance to confirm that the defendant would continue to act accordingly and act appropriately.
And Ms. Adelfio, I take it that because of that, it would be the Commonwealth's position that absent an express releasing of the defendant from supervised probation, she continued to be on supervised probation.
That's correct, Your Honor, that the conditions placed on her in the January 2013 order continued absent an express release.
Well, even without an express release, if there was an order that was actually a final disposition order, that would also have released her.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that's why this case is different from White. This case continued probation pending disposition. It did not set a date certain, and the January 2013 order continued the case, as you said, until there was a final disposition in the case. The July 2014 order merely memorialized an intent to dismiss. It did not actually dismiss the case. It left open the possibility of the court continuing to exercise its authority over the defendant.
It didn't leave open the possibility. The court was continuing.
That's correct.
It, certainly in the court's mind, that's why when the conditions weren't met, it did not award the disposition that had been discussed at the July order.
That's correct, Your Honor. So given that the conditions from January 2013 were in effect because it was not a final, the July order was not
what
a final order.
Do you think the March 19, 2013 order has, does it have any effect?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that the January 2013 order controls it. The March 2013 probation order, while it placed her on indefinite probation, I think that the January 2013 order makes clear that it was actually probation pending the disposition of her case. And so if the court has any further questions, I'll move on to my second argument, which is even if she wasn't on probation at the time she ran away from home, clearly a child is required, or not required, or clearly good behavior contemplates a child not absconding without telling a guardian of her whereabouts. And clearly the running away is substantial misconduct. This particular defendant had substantial contact with JNDR. She had noticed that she was expected to be of good behavior, and the types of behaviors that were contemplated as requirements of her. She knew from the probation that she was expected to be at home. She was expected not to run away, and plainly incorrect that a child does not. It's plainly incorrect that good behavior constitutes any sort of behavior other than staying at home and telling your parents where you are. So, unless the court has any further questions, I ask you to affirm both of the defendant's convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So I think turning to the more of the due process argument, which was the third assignment of error. So the due process argument is really about whether or not she knew that she was still on probation after July 25th. So
would you concede that if the fair reading of the July order is that this is not a final disposition, disposition is deferred, the case is not disposed of, and the disposition means the same thing in the July order that it meant in the January order. But they mean the same thing, that she has no due process argument because she's on notice.
Well,
if they mean the same thing, and I know you disavow that position completely.
Well, no, I don't believe so, because she's given a copy of an order on July 25th that lists only two terms.
But she knows what was in the January order that says until this case
Correct.
Is disposed of, you're on probation.
Correct.
And it says this case is not disposed of. Why does that erase that condition?
Well, I guess it depends on whether or not disposition means finally disposed of.
Well, and
that was the premise.
Right.
And that's the premise of the hypothetical.
Okay.
So
well, then
so
the question
if they
is,
mean the same thing, if disposition means the same thing in both orders, there's no due process problem.
No, because how is she supposed to know that?
Because disposition is spelled the same way in both orders, and it's the same word.
I mean, I guess my position is still that when they're in court on July 25th, and her father didn't hear probation being mentioned, and she did not believe that she was still on probation, the probation officer had been in contact with her mother. We know that. But there was no testimony that she was in direct contact with the juvenile. And the contact with her mother was since January 9th of 2014. There was no distinction between the time frames. So when this order lists these two certain terms, she's obviously thinking, great, I have to do this. I have to be of good behavior, and I have to write this paper. The paper was never an issue. But she's like, I have two terms for 3 months, and then I'm done. And that is the essence of the due process violation. And for all those reasons, we would request that you overturn the decision of the trial court.
Thank you. As is our custom, we'll come down and recount.